Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. This lecture is about international institutions and marks a shift in focus from the causes of effects to the effects of causes. That is, we're no longer asking why states don't cooperate more, and instead asking how specific factors influence the likelihood of cooperation. You may have noticed that all of the answers I gave to that first question came from models that embodied the core assumptions of neorealism. That is, we treated states as unitary actors and assumed that the only constraints on their actions were material, ignoring international institutions and domestic politics. We're now going to ask how our understanding of international cooperation changes once we acknowledge the existence of those factors. In other words, we're going to start building from the assumptions of neoliberalism and classical liberalism, and to a lesser extent, constructivism. We'll then move on to analyze conflict in much the same manner, beginning with the general question of why peace doesn't always prevail, and then turning our attention to the impact of international institutions and domestic politics once again. On the first slide, as always, I lay out the goals for this lecture. First, I will present the epiphenomenal critique of international institutions, which I think needs to be the starting point of any discussion of their effectiveness. Second, I will discuss when and how international institutions solve specific problems that might otherwise prevent cooperation, namely coordination, collaboration, and trust problems, all of which you should have a firm grasp of by this point. Let me first clarify what I mean by international institutions, though. The international part should be obvious, but what exactly is an institution? Well, there are three basic types: a bureaucratic organization with staff and a headquarters, explicit rules or laws that are written down somewhere, and a common set of expectations that is widely recognized but remains implicit. The debate between neorealists and neoliberals focuses primarily on organizations like the UN, the WTO, NATO, or the EU, and formal agreements like NAFTA and other trade agreements, most military alliances other than NATO, the Montreal and Kyoto Protocols, or the Geneva Conventions. I should say here that constructivists, to their credit, are far less likely to overlook the potential impact of informal institutions. But to keep this lecture from running too long, I'm only going to focus on the neoliberal response to a major neorealist critique. Okay, turn to the second slide, where I explain the epiphenomenal critique of international institutions. What do I mean by epiphenomenal? Well, generally speaking, that is a characteristic possessed by something that is secondary to, meaning it is caused by, some other phenomenon. That term's not unique to IR, but it comes up in modules like this one because it's often used by realists to describe international institutions. In other words, realists allege that international institutions are caused by cooperation rather than a cause of cooperation. That's a bit abstract, isn't it? Perhaps an example will help. Suppose you were to read tomorrow that a new study finds that people who are in relationships that they've acknowledged on Facebook are less likely to cheat on one another than those who are in relationships that are not Facebook official. What might we conclude from that? Well, one interpretation, the one you can be sure the press release would favor, is that making your relationship Facebook official somehow strengthens it. But that conclusion does not follow from the evidence provided. As I argued in the lecture on statistical analysis, when we're presented with information like this, we need to be concerned that the reason we're seeing a correlation between X and Y is that there's some third factor Z that is causally responsible for variation in both, without the one directly impacting the other. For example, it's at least plausible that when one partner is not fully committed to the relationship, they will both balk at the idea of acknowledging it on Facebook and also seek out, or at least be less likely to turn down, opportunities to hook up with other people. Put differently, one might think that the pre-existing strength of the relationship determines both whether it gets acknowledged on Facebook and whether people cheat. If so, the acknowledgement on Facebook would be epiphenomenal. And that would mean that telling people to push their partners to go on Facebook and declare that they're in a relationship would be giving them bad advice. Not only wouldn't it have the desired effect, if the epiphenomenal claim is correct, but it might even be counterproductive. I'm not trying to give anyone relationship advice. If I were, you'd be well advised not to take it. That hypothetical study I just referred to the best of my knowledge, remains hypothetical, though I'm sure someone will publish it eventually. I just chose that example because I think it might be easier for some of you to relate to. The more important point is that scholars of international relations disagree about the impact of international institutions in precisely the same way that reasonable people might disagree about what that study would show. Neoliberals believe that institutions facilitate cooperation that would not otherwise have occurred, whereas realists tend to think they're more of a way of acknowledging what was already going to happen when one or more parties sees value in broadcasting it to the world. In fact, the line between neoliberalism as an explanatory theory of international relations and neoliberalism as a political philosophy can sometimes get a little blurry. That is, one set of scholars claims to be in the business of uncovering the truth about the world in a very detached and objective manner, but many of them go a step further and advocate forming new international institutions as well as enlarging the ones that already exist. They are basically giving advice on how to conduct international relations. And another set of scholars is basically saying, wait a minute, you're telling us to do that because you think states that are currently doing their own thing will suddenly play nice and do as the international community wishes if we just get them to sign a piece of paper? You haven't demonstrated that. All you've got is a correlation that isn't the least bit surprising. In other words, there's really no debate about whether we see higher levels of cooperation among states that belong to international institutions which aim to promote that exact form of cooperation. We absolutely do see that in many cases, and realists don't deny it. Across a wide range of substantive domains, such as trade, environmental protection, and the treatment of prisoners of war, studies have found a strong, positive correlation between joint membership in international institutions and cooperative outcomes. What that means, however, is open to interpretation. Initially, neoliberals were quick to tout those correlations in and of themselves, which would only make sense if we thought they were evidence of causation. But as we've discussed, correlation does not imply causation. If international institutions promote cooperation in the sense that their members would not have cooperated to the same extent if they hadn't joined. That's great, but we need more than just correlation to convince skeptics. We need a mechanism. That still can't put the matter to rest entirely. As I argued in the lecture on statistical analysis, we can't control the behavior of world governments the way we can participants in a laboratory. And that means we can never know for sure that the relationships we observe are causal. But for a lot of people, having a clear theoretical argument about how an increase in X, say, signing an agreement, causes a change in Y, removing barriers to trade, for example, goes a long way to mitigating concerns about third factors being solely responsible for the patterns we observe. So now we're going to ask what the mechanism might be. Since I've identified three reasons why states might fail to cooperate, even when doing so would leave everyone better off than they are at present, namely coordination problems, collaboration problems, and trust problems, the obvious thing to do is ask whether international institutions can solve these problems. If not, then we probably should conclude that the epiphenomenal critique bites pretty hard. But if they can, at least some of the time, then realist skepticism about international institutions is probably overblown. Again, this won't settle the matter definitively. There's still plenty of room for disagreement about exactly how much of the correlation is causal. But I'm going to try to convince you that it makes sense to assume that some of the time, international institutions are solving real problems and thus facilitating cooperation that would not have otherwise occurred. Let's start with coordination problems. In the model of coordination discussed previously, we had two students who were hoping to run into each other on Friday night. We assumed that they either couldn't or wouldn't communicate beforehand. But now suppose they can. Maybe they talked after class one day and one mentioned to two that they were pretty sure that they'd be going to Top Bar with their friends on Friday, and two said that perhaps they'd meet them there. That's almost an informal, non-binding agreement to meet up. This being Britain, one must always be non-committal about social engagements, but whatever. Would that solve the problem? Actually, yeah, it might. We can't be certain that they'd both end up at Top Bar, of course, but P1 is likely to be fairly close to 1.0 now. Not equal to 1, because 2 knows that 1's plans could change, but nowhere near 0.5 either. So unless player 2 really, really doesn't like Top Bar, which would imply a big gap between beta overline and beta underline, and thus a large P1 hat, then a large value for P1 all but ensures cooperation. Obviously, in the real world, informal agreements such as this get violated all the time, but they're honored even more often, and coordination in the absence of any sort of agreement, even an informal one, is quite rare. It's rare enough, in fact, that we can safely say that institutions have the power to mitigate coordination problems. Maybe they can't eliminate them altogether, but they cut down on them. And they don't need to be formal to do that. As you can see on the slide, there are examples of international institutions that were designed to solve coordination problems. The International Organization for Standardization, or the ISO for short, aims to create a common set of expectations when it comes to manufacturing, technology, health, and food safety. The International Telecommunication Union allocates radio frequencies and satellite orbits. The International Civil Aviation Organization requires that all pilots at least those of commercial aircraft with international flights, speak English as one of their languages. None of these institutions has any real means of enforcement. But when we're dealing with pure coordination problems, the concern isn't that people will promise to cooperate and then go on to defect. That is the worry with collaboration problems, which we'll get to in a minute. But with coordination problems, the only real concern is whether we can get everyone on the same page. Providing clear, common standards or expectations is often all that's needed to get us there. And that's precisely what some of the world's most successful, if unsung, institutions do. I don't want to oversell this. The ability to solve coordination problems is only so impressive, given that they're relatively easy to overcome anyway. But we don't want to downplay this point either. Coordination problems are not as difficult to overcome as collaboration problems, but neither are they trivial. In certain circles, it's fashionable to mock international institutions because of their inability to bring rogue states to heel. And while it's absolutely true that none of the major institutions we've got today has the power to compel uncooperative states to obey the will of the international community, and many on the other end of the spectrum seem either unaware of this or strangely unbothered by it, there's a lot to be said for helping states reap the benefits of cooperation. Put differently, it's true that international institutions can't do very much to deter states, or non-state actors, from pursuing policies that destabilize the international community when said states, or non-state actors, are strongly committed to such policies. But most people don't appreciate how often states who have all the right intentions nonetheless fail to reach the right outcome. If the best we can say about international institutions is that they make such tragic situations a little less likely to occur, well, that ain't nothing. And we've only discussed coordination problems so far. Let's move on to collaboration problems then. Think back to the model of collaboration from our previous lecture. Suppose that 1 and 2 wrote out a cleaning schedule, whereby each of them is responsible for the cleaning every other week. That is, the first week of the month, player 1 will clean while player 2 does not. In the second week, 2 cleans while 1 does not, and so on. They've put this in writing and hung it up on the wall or the fridge or whatever. Does that solve the problem? Maybe, but if so, it's probably only because they're playing the same game over and over again, and that allows them to punish one another for breaking the agreement by refusing to hold up their end in the future. That is, if 1 cleans the first week, as they're supposed to, but 2 doesn't clean when their turn comes the following week, then 1 likely won't clean the third week. At that point, the agreement either breaks down altogether, or 2 steps up and does their part. If the agreement sticks, it's because the overtime nature of their interaction allowed them to solve the collaboration problem. The thing hanging on the wall? Just a scrap of paper. In other words, there's no reason to think that voluntary agreements that lack enforcement mechanisms can solve collaboration problems. As I said when I first introduced the concept, it's entirely possible that long-term thinking, the need to get along with someone you share a living space with, could compel 1 and 2 to clean in the first place. And if the cost of cleaning isn't too high, then both of the outcomes where one person cleans while the other one doesn't are possible even in the short run, so of course they might settle on taking turns. Our constructivist friends would say there's no reason to expect a problem in the first place, since we have pretty strong norms about what's expected of you when you share a living space, and most of us behave in accordance with norms of what's acceptable most of the time. None of that tells us anything about international institutions, though. It just means that situations that seem like they could give rise to a collaboration problem won't always do so. When they do, however, asking the people involved to sign a formal agreement isn't going to help. Even if they did, they wouldn't abide by it. There have, in fact, been various attempts to solve collaboration problems simply by having states promise to be nice. They haven't met with much success, though. The most striking example of this is the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928, which basically sought to outlaw war. We all know what happened roughly a decade later. To be fair, some would argue that the Kellogg-Briand Pact laid the groundwork for later developments in international law, which have been at least partially successful, but this is still not a shining example of solving problems. Similarly, the Kyoto Protocol sought to reduce global CO2 emissions to 1990 levels in order to mitigate the effects of climate change. It hasn't been as big a failure as the Kellogg-Briand Pact, but neither has it been terribly successful. Some states have come close to meeting their targets, most of whom likely would have even absent a treaty because of their domestic politics, but many have not. And some of the most important states, like the US, China, India, and Brazil, either have not ratified or do not face binding targets. You'd have a hard time arguing that the cooperation most people were calling for when that agreement was signed has even occurred, let alone that it did so because the Kyoto Protocol solved a collaboration problem. What about our last set of problems, those dealing with trust? Here, I think the news is pretty good, and perhaps surprising. I, for one, didn't appreciate the point I'm about to make until I worked through the theoretical model you're about to see. Turn to the fifth slide. There, you see a model of reassurance. This is a bit different than the previous models we've discussed, in that some of the decisions are made sequentially before we arrive at a normal form game. That is, we begin with player 1 deciding whether to propose an agreement to player 2 or not. If they do so, player 2 must then decide whether to accept that agreement. Regardless of what happens at the front end, though, they then play the game we used to discuss trust problems. If, and only if, player 1 proposes an agreement that player 2 accepts, an international institution is formed. Should that happen, both sides incur some cost, represented by kappa. That's the symbol that looks like a K. That cost is paid no matter how the second part of the game ends. It's the cost of forming the institution, irrespective of whether the states follow through by cooperating. I include this because many agreements have preconditions. States are often not allowed to become members of an institution until they change some aspect of their domestic or foreign policy, which may or may not have anything to do with the subject of the treaty. I'll talk about some examples at the end of the lecture. The point for now is that what each side does with their trade practices, whether they remove the specific barriers targeted by the agreement, determines which cell of the matrix they end up in, and thus whether their overall payoff will include beta or tau or E. But no matter what happens down there, if an agreement was proposed and accepted, then both incur cost kappa. That cost may be arbitrarily small, even equal to zero in the extreme, but whatever kappa is, it kicks in. The other important thing to note about kappa, which I haven't written down on the slide, is that the size of it depends on the player's types. That is, there will be two versions of Kappa, one relatively small, written as Kappa underline in blue, and one relatively large, written as Kappa overline in red. The assumption here is that the red type of each player, the one with the larger temptation to block imports, also finds it more painful to change their policies in order to be admitted into an international institution. Everything else is the same as it was in the lecture on trust problems. Everything. The E's can be either positive or negative, the two sides don't know one another's taus, but they can make educated guesses, etc., etc. Incidentally, we don't need to have two things vary by type. I've analyzed other versions of this model where just one thing does, beta. The results are essentially the same, though the substantive interpretation is a little different. I decided it would be better to maintain continuity with a previous model at the expense of requiring two things to vary by type. But if anyone out there is wondering whether this argument requires some funny business, the answer is no, it doesn't. I just wanted to be able to say, as I just did, that once we get to the final stage of the game, it is exactly the same as the model of trust. As with the lecture on trust problems, I'm not going to discuss every possibility. I just want to highlight one particularly interesting one. Because the mere fact that it exists at all, even if it's not the only way for situations like this to play out, tells us something really important about international institutions. In that most interesting equilibrium, player one proposes an agreement if and only if they are blue. Two accepts if and only if they are blue. And both players decide whether or not to allow imports the same way they would in the model of trust. That is, if the E terms are positive and imbalanced trade is seen as tolerable, then there's no real problem and the blue types go ahead and allow whether they trust the other player or not. But if the E terms are negative, then the blue types only allow if they trust the other side. The red types, to be clear, still do not cooperate. This is not an argument about how international institutions force bad states to behave themselves. As I said previously, I think critics of international institutions are basically right to point out that they largely don't have the power to do that. Though we will talk more later in the module about how that critique, like the epiphenomenal one, is a bit overstated. What makes this equilibrium interesting is that the blue types always cooperate no matter how distrustful they might have been of the other side initially. That is, the model is telling us that even if realists are right, that the only states who join institutions are ones who were already willing to cooperate, that doesn't actually mean that institutions are pointless, or epiphenomenal, really. In both the model of trust and the model of reassurance, blue types are happy to remain at the outcome of mutual cooperation if they reach it. But in the model of trust, there's no guarantee that they will. As I hope you'll recall, I gave some numerical examples to show how 1 and 2 might fail to cooperate even when they're both blue, because they don't know that they're both blue. Here, that wouldn't happen. The very act of proposing or accepting an agreement that comes with preconditions the red types would not accept reassures the other side that you must be a blue type. Note, however, that this only works if the preconditions are just right. They need to be big enough to deter red types from trying to trick blue types into trusting them, but not so big as to make blue types abandon the agreement. That's what that final bullet point establishes, by the way. When kappa underline, the blue one, is less than beta, the blue types benefit enough from guaranteeing that cooperation will succeed that they're willing to make whatever sacrifices are required to meet the preconditions of the institution. When kappa overline, the red one, is greater than tau overline, also red, that ensures that even if the red types knew that signing the agreement would trick the blue types into trusting them, and that they could therefore get their temptation payoff, they still wouldn't bother. They'd rather take the zero they get from revealing that they're not trustworthy by rejecting the agreement, or failing to propose one in the first place, than deal with those preconditions. In other words, I'm not saying that all, or even most, international institutions solve trust problems. I'm saying that they have the power to do so if their preconditions are just right. If the preconditions are trivial, red types will be willing to sign agreements despite having no intention of abiding by their terms, and thus the act of signing loses its power to reassure blue types. On the other end, if the preconditions are too stringent, no one will bother with the agreement, not even the blue types. But if they're just right, then agreements have the power to solve trust problems, and so might actually be giving us cooperation that wouldn't otherwise occur, rather than merely being a byproduct of something that was going to happen anyway. Again, I don't want to oversell this point. We saw in the lecture on trust problems that when the stakes are high enough, states will go for it even if they don't trust one another very much. So the problems that international institutions are solving are medium-sized at best. When there's a lot of money at stake and we don't have a full-blown collaboration problem, then we don't need institutions to get cooperation, because states will already be willing to set aside their fears of exploitation. That doesn't mean that the problems institutions do solve are irrelevant, but it's worth noting that the argument I just laid out has its limitations. According to one recent study, after we make every reasonable attempt to account for the fact that some countries are more likely to sign trade agreements in the first place, we find that the average trade agreement basically doubles trade between the countries involved after 10 years. That's pretty substantial, but when you consider that global trade has increased by nearly 3,000% since 1950, with most of that increase occurring in the last 30 years, a 100% increase over 10 years doesn't sound that amazing. If not for international institutions meant to increase trade, that increase probably would have been more modest, but it still would have occurred. We've got to give institutions some credit, but we can't give them too much credit. Finally, let's talk briefly about why it might make sense to think that trade agreements and the European Union have led to greater cooperation than would have otherwise occurred, and that they've done so, in part, by solving trust problems. The case for viewing trade agreements this way is pretty straightforward. Again, for institutions to solve trust problems, they have to require states to meet moderately demanding preconditions. And it just so happens that most trade agreements, especially in the last few decades, where the evidence of their impact is strongest, do just that. The most common types of precondition for trade agreements concern labor rights and environmental regulations. Interestingly, it seems that these provisions have mostly been added in order to reduce domestic opposition. The anti-globalization movement that reached prominence in the 1990s, especially with the Seattle protests against the WTO, have led many Western politicians to seek out a middle ground, to signal to more radical voters that they understand and are sympathetic to their concerns without going so far out of the mainstream as to oppose trade altogether. One way they've done this, aside from promising to renegotiate existing agreements when they have no intention of doing so, here's looking at you, 2008 Obama, is to demand that no new trade agreements enter into force unless the other country agrees to measures that prevent their workers from being exploited and their environment from being degraded. States haven't been adding preconditions in order to make their agreements more effective, in other words. They've been doing it for domestic reasons. Yet allowing blue types to identify other blue types by saddling agreements with preconditions that no red type would accept has probably had the unintended and quite fortuitous side effect of solving trust problems and making trade agreements more effective. What about the EU? Well, the European Union is a very complex organization. One could easily dedicate an entire module to the study of it. Suffice it to say, it does a lot more than lower barriers to trade, the way NAFTA did for the US, Canada, and Mexico. It also removed barriers to migration for some of its member states, established a common currency for a different subset of states, and create legislative and executive institutions. Some see the EU as the first step in the establishment of a European superstate, more analogous to the Articles of Confederation among the 13 former British colonies than a trade agreement. There's good reason to think that part of the EU's success at integrating so many economies comes from eliminating trust problems. And it has been successful in that regard. I'm not saying it's been an unqualified success in every sense, nor telling anyone that they should want the UK to be part of it. Just saying that it's hard to argue that Europe's economies aren't more integrated as a result of the EU than they would otherwise be, which is good for some people and bad for others, as we'll discuss in the lecture on domestic politics and cooperation. That's partly because of who joined and when, and partly because of the preconditions new members must meet. The EU's origins are in the European Coal and Steel Community, formed in the 1950s by what's known as the Inner Six: Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, France, West Germany, and Italy. For the most part, these countries have more in common with one another, politically, economically, and culturally, than they do most of the other current members. In other words, the countries that we might expect to have the highest levels of trust in one another, and the most harmonious relations, in the sense that I've been using that term, unlikely to be terribly concerned about imbalanced trade, were already cooperating with one another at very high rates by the time the Maastricht Treaty came around in 1993. That's the treaty that established the EU in something like its current form. We didn't need the EU to get to a high level of cooperation amongst the Benelux countries. But between Germany and Greece? There, it's a little harder to believe that the level of economic cooperation we see today, even after the debt crisis, would have occurred absent the EU. Moreover, the sort of preconditions that must be met by new members are precisely the sort that make the reassurance story I just told more plausible. Any state seeking to join the EU must satisfy what are known as the Copenhagen criteria, which require states to meet minimum standards in terms of democratic governance, rule of law, human rights, and a market-based economy. These criteria are much more demanding than typical preconditions for a free trade agreement, but membership in the EU brings much bigger benefits as well. And for most of the states considering accession, these criteria are demanding, but not out of reach, which is exactly as they should be if the institutions to address trust problems. I'm not saying that's why the Copenhagen criteria exist, of course. as with labor and environmental provisions and trade agreements, I think they're there more to satisfy domestic constituents, Euroskeptics in this case. But that doesn't detract from the argument that they had the effect of solving trust problems. So, how do we judge international institutions when it comes to promoting cooperation? Well, there's room for disagreement here, but I think the best answer, at the moment, is that international institutions matter less than it might seem on the surface, because there definitely is something to the epiphenomenal critique, but they likely have contributed to the growth in economic cooperation between states over the past few decades. They've done this, I think, by solving coordination problems and, especially, trust problems. There's very little reason to think they've solved collaboration problems, and trust problems tend to disappear as the benefit of cooperation goes up anyway, so we don't want to exaggerate their impact. But I think it's hard to argue that all of the cooperation we see taking place within institutions would have happened even without those institutions.